50 episodes. 50 episodes. Matthew Demby, can you believe we've reached this milestone and we're nowhere near finishing our journey through Stock Aitken Waterman?
Yes, what a ride. We've come so far, all those great records, with so many more to go. We're sitting right at the very top of the mountain at this point in Soar's most successful year, with some big drops and peaks still ahead of us.
And in this episode, we're going to tick off three more singles, two from Soar's crop of young singers and one from a music industry veteran. Shall we start with Age Before Beauty?
Do we have any choice? Well, this could be complicated because I seem to remember that quite a few grandmas used to find that veteran you mentioned pretty hot back in the 80s.
Well, we don't actually have a choice, of course, since we're following the UK release order. And coming out in August of 1989 was a collaboration between the Hit Factory and one of the most successful male singers of all time. He hadn't been allowed to appear on Ferry Cross the Mersey, but Stock Aitken Waterman made it up to Cliff Richard by giving him yet another top three hit in a career that was already into its fourth decade. This is I Just Don't Have the Heart. That was I Just Don't Have the Heart, a number three hit for Cliff Richard. He wasn't knighted until 1995, which was included on his 29th studio album, Stronger, which was released a couple of months later. Cliff, of course, was no stranger to the upper reaches of the UK chart. By this point, he already had 12 number one hits spanning the 50s.
Got myself a crying, talking, sleeping, walking, living dog.
60s.
The young ones, darling, we're the young ones.
70s.
It's so funny how we don't talk anymore.
And 80s.
Christmas time, mistletoe and wine.
And among his many achievements, he'd also finished second at Eurovision in 1968 with another UK chart topper.
Congratulations. Celebrations.
That's some pop legacy. Matt, where do you stand on Cliff Richard?
Well, back in 1989, I stood several steps back from him, Gavin, if only to make room for the mums and the aunties. As a snotty teenage boy back then, Cliff was pure cringe to me. But I did secretly think some of his songs, like Wired for Sound, were pretty decent pop tunes. Flash forward all these decades and we don't really care about being cool anymore, do we? And I can now appreciate the sheer scale of Cliff's musical legacy, especially as someone who is still kicking ass in the music industry well into middle age. And that's no small achievement at all. So belated kudos to you, Sir Cliff.
I was, and still am, quite partial to a bit of 80s Cliff. I wouldn't say he was cool during that decade, but he was still very much a viable pop star. He had broad appeal thanks to songs like these. Okay, that was Wired for Sound, which you mentioned, Matt, The Only Way Out, Never Say Die, and Some People. By 1989, however, with music changing so drastically thanks to the rise of club tracks, Cliff's mainstream career was really onto its last gasp. For a pop singer wanting to stay relevant, it made perfect sense to team up with the biggest pop producers in Britain.
Yes, Cliff ran into the boys at an industry awards lunch where they were getting a gong for Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up. According to Cliff's account in his autobiography, The Dreamer, he leaned over to them and said, "If you get another song like that, you know where I am." Cliff went on to write in the book, "Serious music critics sniffed at their fun disco pop. But so what? Serious music critics weren't so keen on me either these days. I've never been a music snob and I thought I had a lot in common with Saw. Like me, they loved pop music and they loved having hits."
With it all agreed that Stockaken Waterman would write and produce a song for Cliff, it was down to Mike and Matt to come up with the goods.
Yes, but Pete Waterman says he came up with the title. He recalled in one interview, "We had to imagine we were Cliff and dream up an appropriate story. I said, just imagine Cliff had fallen in love with this girl and then he met someone else. What would he do? We thought, well, he's such a spiffing chap, he wouldn't have the heart to tell her. And that's where it all came from." When it came to recording with Cliff, there was one problem. As an industry veteran, he'd had his established ways of working and he insisted on hearing a demo before he came into the studio. Trouble is, that wasn't the way that Saw did things. Mike Stock wrote in his book, The Hit Factory, "Why do a shabby version of something? Go for it or don't bother." We gently persuaded Cliff that it would be all right on the day of the session. So, for the first time in his professional life, he didn't hear the song before coming into the studio to make the record.
Yeah, that's one thing that this podcast has really made clear. Any idea that Saw had a cupboard full of demos just waiting to be dished out to artists is simply not true. There might have been tracks that didn't progress to release stage, like all those Bananarama songs from the 1988 to 89 sessions, but Mike and Matt didn't write songs on the off chance that someone might be able to record them one day. Let's hear from Julian Gingell, the Jules from Jules and Stone, and one half of The Alias, about that lack of a demo process.
They didn't really do demos. They barely ever did demos. I don't think there was the time for it. A, there wasn't the time for it, and B, they were writing a song for an artist, and the artist would come in and sing it. They weren't kind of writing a song and then, oh, right, who will this work for? They just didn't work like that. They had confidence enough that the song would be there at the end of the day and would work for the artist intended. Mike would always have an idea. Mike and Matt would know where the track would be sounding like, you know, a week into the future. So they didn't need to kind of, you know, it was all in the mind's eye for Mike and Matt. So they didn't, you could have a really basic track and they could see, you know, they would have the foresight to know. They'd be sitting there, Mike would be on the piano, Matt would probably be sort of strumming on the guitar or whatever. And I don't know what alchemy went on in there, but because we were outside sort of tapping our fingers and doing whatever. But at the end of the day, the track would come in and then, yeah, it would be your lyrics would be done, the melody would be done. And then it was a case of getting a basic track and the lyrics printed. And then more often than not, the singer would be in, you know, the next day or, you know, in some scary cases, like in 2 hours. I've got memories of just like being called in like sort of 5 or 6 o'clock. Right, let's get a drum track down before we go to the pub. And then they'd a kick and a snare and then a chord sequence would go down over the three and a half minutes. And then if they had time, a bass line. I'm sure in some times that, you know, it would be very, very a basic drum pad if they were kind of trying to go in for a specific, if they wanted to go for a specific style or tempo or something like that, then they would kick off. But everything was basic before the song was written. They would not go far down that road of producing. The song was always pretty much the first thing on the agenda.
Right. Well, naturally, Mike hadn't been completely unprepared for the session. He'd built a song idea using Cliff's performance on Wired for Sound as his vocal reference point. Quote, "When I sang the tune, Cliff said it was too high for him. And when I told him I'd checked with Wired for Sound, he quickly informed me that Wired had been recorded 8 years ago and his voice had dropped a bit since then. So I took the song down a tone and he was brilliant. He sang it perfectly in tune very quickly. It was a great experience."
Yeah, Matt Aitken also has good memories of working with Cliff on I Just Don't Have the Heart. Let's hear them now.
We had a template at the time, which was taken from a track by a group called Ten City. Dum 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 ba dum 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 ba dum dum
dum dum dum ba dum 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 ba dum ba dum. That's the way love is, right?
Yeah, that feel. We used that on probably half a dozen tracks, and it was going really well for us. And we thought, let's just do something with Cliff that is on this groove and take him into an area that's slightly more R&B than he'd done before. We didn't want to go and do another Congratulations or Move It or Mistletoe and Wine. Now, I can't remember whose input that was. That might have been Pete's input. It might not. When we were structuring the chorus, There was a little turnaround, which da-da-da-da-da-da, which I think we might have used on Donna Summer as well. But it seemed to be something that we thought made the chorus work. It's really technical, this, isn't it? But he was just, you know, to have him in the studio, you know, talk about growing up with somebody. You know, Cliff had been with us all of our lives, and to have him in our studio was a little bit tricky. And at first, I thought he was going to be a little bit diva-ish, but far from it. He was absolutely just the consummate pro in every aspect of everything he said, everything he did. And, you know, turn the mic on, let's record. It's done. It's just done. And it's Cliff, and he's singing your song, and how good does it get? Cliff told us that whatever happened in the studio, it was going to have to pass the test. And the test was that he was going to play it to his milkman. And if his milkman liked it, then he'd go with it. But if his milkman didn't like it, he wouldn't go with it.
I did speak to Cliff, not for our podcast, but I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago. And he said it was too fast for him to perform live.
Probably too high. We performed it live with him at Wembley Stadium. Well, we weren't live. He was live. We were miming like buggery. But, well, he did it okay then. This is a guy that plays tennis in 90 degrees heat. You know, he's super fit. I don't know why it should be too quick for him.
Yes, Cliff was the exception to the PWL rule that unfinished songs couldn't be taken home by artists. When Cliff left with the tape, he promised he wouldn't play it to anyone or let it leak. But Mike wrote in his book, when he came to do the final mix, Cliff admitted he had played it to his mum and that she'd loved it. Even worse, he had played it to his milkman. I fell off my stool. Why did you play it to the milkman? Oh, I play all my songs to the milkman. And if he likes it, then I know it will be a hit.
Well, I also thought I Just Don't Have the Heart was a hit. I liked it as soon as I heard it, and I'm no milkman. It's a really well-written song, and just as with Donna Summer, it felt like Saw went to extra effort to get it right. Cliff even got a rare middle eight out of them. If I stop to think about the good times that we shared, I could fool myself.
Yes, another winning radio pop song. I didn't have much time for it back in 89 due to the Cliff factor, but in retrospect, it's definitely one of Saw's stronger compositions from this period, and Cliff does a typically good job vocally. It's always a bonus when the talent can really sing. And speaking of vocals, there's a bit of a story behind the ad-libs and warbling you hear on this track, which are pretty unusual for a Saw record. Apparently, this was Cliff's vocal warm-up in the studio, and he had no idea it was going to be used on the track. When Cliff heard it in the final mix, he offered to re-record, but Waterman declined, saying the track was perfect as is.
As well as having the bones of I Just Don't Have the Heart ready for their big session with Cliff, Stock Aitken Waterman were so prepared that they even had a backup just in case Cliff didn't like I Just Don't Have the Heart. They ended up not needing it, but you can hear Mike's guide vocal for Best of Friends on his website. And here's a little bit now. So if you need me, just
right, to me that track sounds absolutely perfect for 80s Cliff, but with the tabloid narrative around his love life at this time, I could see why he'd shy away from a lyric like, so far we are the best of friends, but that's where the story ends.
Of course, the song would end up being recorded by Lonnie Gordon for her album, so as always, Stock Aitken Waterman didn't waste anything. It didn't sit there in the cupboard languishing, it was put to good use eventually.
Right. Now, although I Just Don't Have the Heart was a huge success in the UK, taking Cliff back up to the top end of the charts and matching the success of his prior track, his 100th single, The Best of Me, not everyone was happy. First of all, Cliff wasn't available for TV, which Mike Stock thinks cheated the track out of a more prestigious placing. Quote, the week it was number three in August 89, Cliff was in Portugal playing tennis, so he couldn't go on Top of the Pops. I'm sure it would have been number one if he'd been there to promote it.
Yeah, I'm not so sure, Mike Stock. I don't know about that claim that Cliff only missed out on a chart topper because he wasn't on Top of the Pops. The two singles above, I Just Don't Have the Heart, when it was at number three, were Swing the Mood and Ride on Time. If Jive Bunny was able to block a brand new Kylie single from number one, as had happened with Wouldn't Change a Thing, then there was no way Cliff was getting past the medley-loving Bunny. And as for the Black Box song, which was the highest-selling single in the UK for 1989, well, more on that later.
On a much more ominous note for Saw was the sheer scale of backlash the collaboration had apparently provoked in some quarters. Mike recalled in his book, Cliff told us something rather disturbing. By the way, I've been out on tour around the world and I've never had to defend anybody the way I have you guys. I'm a Christian and I've never had to defend God as much as I've had to defend you, unquote. Ouch. Pete Waterman also touched on this same conversation with Cliff in his book, and it was obvious that it had stung him deeply. Quote, all we were doing was making pop records, and somehow we were being seen as despicable. That was something I always found quite extraordinary.
There was also a backlash of kinds in Australia to this track, with Richard Wilkins, the host of MTV Australia, infamously ripping the song off air mid-play because he was so outraged that Cliff Richard had worked with Stock Aitken Waterman.
Well, I remember Richard's mullet, and that's all I have to say.
I remember it happening, and I was really annoyed because Stock Aitken Waterman records weren't played everywhere, and it was finally, oh, good, MTV's going to play it. And then he pulled it off. I was so furious. But it was just typical of the attitude towards Stock Aitken Waterman at that time. Now, as you heard me mention to Matt Aitken, I did interview Cliff Richard some time ago and asked him about I Just Don't Have the Heart. And the one thing I remember him saying was that he found it quite fast and he had difficulty replicating that live. And this is in, you know, the last couple of decades. In 1989, he possibly didn't have that same problem. I wish I had kept that recording, but you're just going to have to take my word for it. But I agree, the song certainly does kick along, and Cliff would get some more of that PWL sound on two of his 1990 releases. First of all, Phil Harding remixed a subsequent single, Stronger Than That, and then Harding and Kurnow remixed classic track We Don't Talk Anymore. Let's hear a bit of those two. Some more PWL Cliff goodness there. Now, from a man who was a teen heartthrob decades earlier, we turn now to the latest hit for a man who was a teen heartthrob in 1989.
Yes, this is the fifth single from Jason Donovan's mega-selling debut album. Every Day I Love You More, charted in September of 89. Let's have a listen. That was Every Day, another big success for Jason in the UK, hitting number two there as well as number one in Ireland. But things were now starting to cool down for him across most of Europe and back home in Australia. More on that later.
Yeah, I think this was the best choice of next single from 10 Good Reasons. I prefer You Can Depend on Me as a song, but I think Jason's delivery on Every Day is stronger. It's got a really memorable chorus and some nice little touches, like the echo on Everything I do, I do for you. Plus, it meant we got another hit with one of my favorite things in 80s music, titles with brackets in them. While we're talking about the title, it's worth noting it is Every Day, two words, not Every Day.
Well, thank you for that clarification.
No problem.
Yes, this track is more sedate than tracks like Nothing Can Divide Us or Too Many Broken Hearts, and it more naturally suits Jason's range and abilities. Although the backing vocals are still cranked up to 10 in places here, it's an enjoyable little pop song that goes off the well-worn path while still hitting all the right marks and giving you the thrills that you want from a Stock Aitken and Waterman pop song.
And one factor that potentially influenced fans to go out and buy Every Day when they already had the album was the presence of a fresh new B-side, and not a cobbled together from leftover bits of Change Your Mind B-side, like Just Call Me Up. No, I Guess She Never Loved Me was a proper song and a rare original Saw ballad, for better or worse. Yes, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, that's a really nice, solid B-side, some good songwriting there. And I've got to say, Jason's vocals are improving out of sight by this point. It's a noticeably strong performance from him. I like it. Good stuff.
The week that Every Day debuted on the UK chart at number 3, it rose to number 2 the following week, 10 Good Reasons was into its 18th week inside the album's top 10, and that had included 4 weeks at number 1. So it's a testament to just how massive Jason was in the UK that a fifth single from an album with that much shelf life already could do so well. And it can't all have been down to the B-side. So what kept Every Day from number one? That'd be this song by Black Box, also 2 words.
Yeah, so great. Black Box there with the Italo House classic Right on Time. As you mentioned, Gavin, the biggest selling record of 89 in the UK, and it held the top spot there for 6 weeks. Jason really never stood a chance against a juggernaut like that. But beyond just denying him what would have been his 4th UK number one, Right on Time is also important to this story because it went on to become one of the defining hits of the 80s-90s transition. It's one of those records that clearly marked the beginning of the end of one era and the birth of another. Black Box flagged a huge change in the pop and dance zeitgeist, one that would soon see Saw scrambling to hold on to their relevance after a long period of mostly neglecting their club roots in pursuit of mass market pop supremacy. But more on that soon enough.
Now, in Australia, Jason's chart fortunes took a nosedive with Every Day I Love You More, which peaked at number 43 on the ARIA chart. Now, it wasn't unusual for a fifth single from an album that had been out for a while to not do so well locally. We had a small population, still do, and once a fan base had the album, it was quite common for subsequent singles to serve just to keep that album ticking along, rather than becoming major hits in their own right. So I doubt anyone was that worried about Jason's sales with Every Day in Australia. To be honest, I don't think Jason was really giving Australia too much thought at all at this point, and I don't really blame him. We've talked before about the negativity that Kylie received from the local media. Well, Jason copped that too.
Yeah, Jason complained to Number One magazine that he wasn't being given a fair go in his home country. Quote, "My records aren't going top 5 in Oz anymore, and neither are Kylie's. They get a bit screwed up over this sex symbol thing there. Basically, they take it too seriously and the establishment won't put me on the radio. If they did, I'm sure my records would sell better, but it's a vicious circle. What bugs me is that John Farnham went through the TV serial thing and became a pin-up, but now he's considered credible. Okay, he's older, but I've paid my dues too." Amid the rapidly escalating Saw backlash, Jason was asked by Smash Hits if he resented being a puppet. His response? "Well, no, because I can do whatever I want to do. And if I didn't like the idea of being in their hands, then I could just leave it, couldn't I? I find that people can be very jealous, you know. Why criticize success? Why criticize what people like? People used to criticize Motown. People used to criticize the Beatles. But 20 years down the track, they realized they were wrong. And it's going to happen with Saw too."
Oh my gosh, is Jason a psychic or what? Here we are, 30, 35 years later, reevaluating Stockake and Waterman. Of course, at the time, we also thought they were pretty great, but some people are catching up with us. Okay, let's talk about something more pleasant now, and the music video for Every Day, which kicked off with a shirtless Jason peering into his fridge and showing off his lean torso while a kettle blew off steam nearby. Come on, don't tell me you weren't all paying the same amount of attention. But we almost didn't get this swoon-worthy video, did we?
No, we didn't. Jason had recorded another video for Every Day, which was shot back-to-back with Sealed with a Kiss over a single night in Melbourne. The idea was to get as much done as possible in one hit because of Jason's all-consuming TV acting schedule at the time. The original video apparently used the same fake beach set as Sealed with a Kiss, but was this time lit for daylight. There are some stills online showing Jason on the sand against that familiar wall mural of crashing waves. But that original video got binned. Let's hear from director Chris Langman to tell the full story.
And he'll talk about the fact that Jason was dancing in the video. What happened in the original video for Every Day that has not seen the light of day?
Just wasn't very good. He's not a natural dancer. He'd be the first to say he wasn't a great dancer. So we were trying to get a bit of rhythm, and neither am I. And we didn't have a choreographer for some steps. It was an availability issue that had to be sort of near the studio where they were working. I had to go and work with Jason to try and get to do Neighbours for one episode to try and get him available so we could get him a way to do the clip. And so we were both up for 24 hours, and it's, you know, and I think it showed. And we were exhausted, you know, and, you know, it's simple as that. We're just exhausted, and we just couldn't get it right.
Was it a continuation of Sealed with a Kiss, like with the same look and the same kind of storyline?
Yeah, the same set.
And so did that get a bit contentious with PWL?
Yeah, it did. That was the one that David and I had disagreements over. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't great. You know, I'd be the first to admit it, you know. Well, like I say, you know, you can't really work at your optimum when you haven't slept for a few days.
The thing I liked most about speaking to Chris Langman is that he didn't try to pretend when things weren't up to scratch. He's a man who calls a dog a dog. And by the sounds of it, the first video for Every Day was not great. Great Dane, perhaps. Now, the new clip was a great showcase for Jason the pop star in his standard issue Bross uniform of white t-shirt, ripped jeans and leather jacket with a prop guitar for good measure. Another bonus about the reshoot, that sneaky scene at the end where we can see Kylie's legs. Incidentally, it was apparently Jason filming Kylie in those outdoor scenes in the Wouldn't Change a Thing video. Ah, young love. But not for much longer, because it was around this time in late 1989 that Kylie and Jason split. But we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to Better the Devil You Know.
Yes, just like Kylie's Wouldn't Change a Thing, this marks a big aesthetic turning point for Jason. And those street scenes especially make it look very British. That, along with the footage of UK Jason mania we were seeing on the TV news, added to a growing sense that Jason now belonged to Britain.
Someone else who's a big fan of the Every Day video is PWL stylist Sharon McPhillamy, because it was the first video she worked on with Jason. Let's hear from her. What do you remember about your first video with Jason?
Oh, well, he's just a joy, isn't he? He's always just the loveliest, loveliest, most accommodating, most beautiful chap. He was very handsome. I think he's probably still not bad. I've not seen him for years, but he looks all right. But he was a good guy, Jason.
And in terms of the styling for that?
Well, the thing is, because we were doing the blue screen, I had to get... Do you know how many blue T-shirts I had? I must have had 30 blue T-shirts to get the right shade of blue. So it was very simple, because that's what he looked like. That's what he looked like in life. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, he had the leather jacket and jeans.
Well, that was more the photo shoot, the leather jacket and the jeans and the guitar, which is actually one of my very favourite images. I always liked that photograph. I called the wood and everything. So, yeah, I was like that one.
Was there a sense of not going too sexy with Jason?
I don't think that was ever in anyone's minds, because Jason just was Jason. No, there was no contrivedness with him. He just was. He wore clothes really well and he liked clothes. So photo sessions with him were really great, because he just loved everything and never gave me any trouble. Never.
Because he was very much the boy next door.
Absolutely. But he really was that.
And I guess we've talked about Kylie going off and becoming a bit more raunchy, and Jason didn't. But that wasn't let's keep him looking wholesome.
No, absolutely not. It was him. That was just him.
Okay, while Jason's career was still firing on all cylinders in the UK, our next single came from an artist whose initial burst of massive success hit a hurdle the second time around. And you know that I'm trying, but what can I do? That was Can't Forget You, the second single by mononymed singer Sonia, and the follow-up to her chart-topping debut. Now, I'm going to preface everything I say from here on in by stating that I love this song. I think it's well-crafted by Mike and Matt, with a good mix, jointly credited to Dave Ford and Phil Harding, and Sonia sings it well. It's a great showcase for her voice. But you knew the butt was coming. I don't think it was the right choice of second single, especially following a song like You'll Never Stop Me Loving You. In fact, many of the things that make the track so good are exactly why it wasn't right for Sonia at this stage, in my opinion. Unlike the exuberant, giddy, I'm not going to take no for an answer feel of You'll Never Stop Me Loving You, Can't Forget You has a much more melancholic tone. It's like she's admitting defeat. She's putting on a brave face, but she's going home and crying into her pillow after seeing her ex. It's no good trying, just can't fight it. How could I fall for somebody new? What teenage misery. And sure, loads of kids Sonia's age and younger would be able to relate to that wrenching heartache where it seems like it's the end of the world, no pun intended, because the guy you're still in love with has moved on. But the sentiment of the song jarred with Sonia's perky persona.
Well, perky little Sonia had earned a huge amount of industry attention with the amazing performance of her number one debut single, and she got more attention with this track, just not the right kind, because in a big shocker for the time, it only got to number 17 on the chart. Pete Waterman has had a lot to say down through the years about Sonia's inability to sustain the huge scale of her barnstorming start, and he always puts her persona at the centre of the problem. He told Smash Hits in 1990, "We aim at having hit records because that's what we love to do. And having hit records with Sonia was difficult at the best of times because of what Sonia is. And what she is a very bright, bubbly little character from Liverpool who is very easy to take the mickey out of." Expanding on that in his autobiography, I Wish It Was Me, he wrote, "Sonia did have a personality and in fact came across like Cilla Black or someone, but she just didn't have enough scope in terms of different facets of her personality for us to be able to do much else with her. There was no mystery or light or shade to her. There was just that perky scouser routine," unquote. But, Gavin, you think it was more about the choice of material, don't you?
Yeah, you only have to see what happened with Sonia's third single, which was A Much Brighter Affair. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. But it returned her to the top 10.
Barely.
A top 10 is a top 10. Now, I think it's the disconnect between Sonia's personality as established by her debut single and the style of Can't Forget You that goes a long way to explaining why it peaked at number 17 in the UK. Sure, it was still a top 20 hit. Top 20 hit's a top 20 hit. But after a number one, that must have been disappointing. Now, don't take my word for it. Here's Julian Gingell again to talk about the chart performance of Can't Forget You and how that went down at PWL.
I do remember on Can't Forget You, I don't think Mike was ever happy with a mix on Can't Forget You, because I think it got mixed while he was away on holiday, because it kind of, where did it get to in the charts, that one? It was relatively, it didn't hit, and I thought he was always a little bit, you know what I mean, about that one, because he thought there was a better version to be had on the mix. I remember hearing him saying that, but he was away at the time.
So people were quite disappointed that Can't Forget You didn't make the top 10 after, you know, You'll Never Stop Me Loving You had been number one.
Yeah, of course, yeah, I'm sure they were, you know, because I guess they were hoping for a potentially, you know, another top five, I'm sure they were looking to that, because they were quite fairly consistent, you know, all their acts were pretty consistent, like the Jason and the Kylie, you know. So, yeah, I guess it was a disappointment, especially after hitting number one on your debut. You know, it sets an expectation, doesn't it?
Thank you, Julian. And it wasn't like PWL and Chrysalis, Sonia's record label, didn't try to make Can't Forget You a big hit. They even made, well, I wouldn't call it a big budget video, but they definitely spent much more money on the video for Can't Forget You than they did on the one for You'll Never Stop Me Loving You. There was a location shoot down in Brighton. Sonia was in a school. She was down by the waterfront. So, you know, that wouldn't have been cheap compared to some little studio thing. So they really were putting a big effort behind this single, weren't they?
Yeah, but I think in stark contrast to Sonia's first video, which was really a hole in one, this one's not nearly as successful. That first clip was a classic example of a lower budget and very simple video getting everything right. It really focused on the singer, who at the time was totally unknown to audiences, and established her with the audience in a fun and very simple way. But the clip for Can't Forget You is not that successful. It's much more elaborate, as you said. It's got lots of location shots and a cast of dozens of extras. But Sonny gets a bit lost here. There are so many long shots and medium shots. In that opening scene at the lockers, you don't even get a really good establishing shot, you know, like a tight shot on her face to set the scene. It's just a mop of red hair behind a milling crowd of school students. It's a bit of a mess, but it does make me want to buy an ice cream and go to Brighton Pier.
Yeah, I actually also asked Shazza about Sonia's outfit in the video and whether they were styling her, you know, compared to Kylie in Wouldn't Change a Thing, who had like the top and the midriff showing and the cutoff jeans. Sonia's got a jeans on, Sonia's got a big jacket on, and whether that was a deliberate choice to keep Sonia looking a little bit more conservative, a little bit more covered up. And Shazza said no, that wasn't the case. What Sonia was wearing in the video was what looked good on her. But despite all that, not even a video down in Brighton could help Can't Forget You get into the top 10. And Matt, there are other reasons why that might have been the case, weren't there?
Well, there was a lot going on around this record. We'd just seen Donna Summer underperform with an excellent record in the last episode, but I think the fate of Can't Forget You was the first really unambiguous, tangible sign of serious trouble ahead for Saw. That's because Sonia, as a very young and very pop artist, completely epitomized PWL's post I Should Be So Lucky strategy. And this is actually my favorite Sonia single. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this record at all. Besides, perhaps, the fact that it suffered from the now intense familiarity most people had with Saw's sound in late 1989. It had been a couple of years of chart saturation. I just think after some pretty serious strategic mistakes by targeting younger and younger kids with increasingly cringeworthy acts like the Reynolds Girls and Big Fun, there had to be a collective breaking point. Cool does matter, and it matters to your brand. So does what's happening with popular tastes. Looking back at this time, Matt Aitken saw that. He told the Roadblock fan newsletter in the 1990s, "Sonia and Big Fun in particular took us into an even more pop area than we had been before. And I think that was the wrong way for us to go at the time because the market was changing," unquote. Now, look at the top five the week this song peaked. It's not only Black Box at number one. At number two, you've got Technotronic with their own massive game changer, Pump Up the Jam. Like Black Box, that record felt so incredibly new and electrifying to me at the time. Yo, pump up the jam, pump it up, while your feet are thumping, and the jam is pumping, look ahead, the crowd are jumping. Pump it up a little more, get the party going on the dance floor, see, cause that's where the party's at, and you'll find out if you do that. A place to stay. That's my best felly. Sorry, Yah Kid K. Well, we've also got in the top five Rebel MC foreshadowing that huge eruption of very pop-friendly, commercially accessible rap that would dominate the charts into the 90s.
And what a great song Street Tough is. Now, one thing that did strike me about that UK chart when Sonia peaked at 17 was that in between that club-heavy top five and number 17, there was quite a lot of adult contemporary artists. Billy Joel, Cher, Tina Turner was in there, Richard Marx. Even Wet 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 were charting with a very middle-of-the-road song, Sweet Surrender. It's like the kids were buying the cool club tunes and older music fans were bypassing Sonia for older artists like the ones I mentioned and Belinda Carlisle, who was also in there. Now, chart performance aside, this is a really enjoyable song, and I know the extended mix in particular is often cited by fans as one of Saw's best. So let's take a listen.
Thank you.
They really were loving those vocal locks in 1989, weren't they?
They sure were. Yep, this is a great classic Saw 12-inch. It's the one Sonia track I'll go to every single time.
One persistent myth about Can't Forget You is that it was written for Kylie and that she even recorded it and didn't like it. Mike has addressed this rumor before, but he answered the question again for us and gave an interesting little detail. Was Can't Forget You originally written for Kylie? And did she record it?
No, it wasn't. No. I've heard a lot of these stories about various songs, and the only one that's true is one of the Donna Summer songs was written for Bananarama and they couldn't take it. That's true.
Which one's that?
That's When Love Takes Over, because it's quite a slow groove on it, and I think they were not keen on that.
Right, interesting. So another problem for Sonia and this record was that we already had a ruling pop princess, Kylie Minogue. That role was very much taken. Sonia was a genuinely great singer, technically far better than Kylie, but she was not someone with the kind of universal appeal that was needed to sustain consistently huge mass market success. And I've got no doubt at all that Kylie would have taken this song somewhere very high in the top five with no effort at all.
I guess Can't Forget You was reasonably similar in sentiment to Tears on My Pillow, and we all know how well that did for Kylie. I guess the difference is that Kylie's first few singles, I Should Be So Lucky, Gotta Be Certain, The Locomotion, were all very up and perky, like You'll Never Stop Me Loving You. It wasn't till her fourth single, Je Ne Sais Pas Pourquoi, that she did something a little bit different. And I think that, you know, I'm repeating myself a little bit, but that was kind of the problem here. Sonia made that transition from single one to single two very quickly. Now, we'll have the single Kylie released before Tears on My Pillow in our next episode, as well as the second hit by Big Fun, and another Donna Summer track. Those three artists all featured in episode 49, but things were very different with these next releases. And that episode, number 49, shattered the record for our fastest downloaded episode. So let me take this opportunity on the occasion of our 50th episode to thank everyone who has joined us on the journey so far. People are still discovering this show every day, and that's down to all of you helping us spread the word.
Yeah, 50 episodes, that's so mind-boggling. And the good news is that we haven't peaked yet. Some of the best Saw records came out in the early 90s, a bunch of my personal favourites. When your favourite artist is growing up with you, that means the world, and we'll see a certain pop princess really deliver on that score soon enough. I, for one, cannot wait. And I want to make it really clear, we wouldn't have made it this far on the podcast without you, dear listeners. Thanks to everybody who's helped me with my research along the way. We don't claim to know everything, so if you've gotten in touch with info over the past 50 episodes or shared things from your personal archives, I'm so, so grateful. A special thanks also to those of you who've written kind reviews on Apple. We do read and deeply appreciate all of those reviews. And thanks to those who've shared the show with like-minded friends. A big shout out especially to the Kylie and Donna fans, two great fan communities who've been incredibly encouraging and enthusiastic recently. Your support really drives us on. So thank you all.
And a few people I'd also like to mention, Warwick, for sending through scans of some really hard to find magazines from the time. Jeff on LinkedIn, yes, people get in touch in all sorts of ways, for helping us get our 5-star status back, and Milo for shouting Matt and I lunch. And of course, thanks to everyone who subscribes via chartbeats.com.au/saw. The bonus episodes, especially when we do track by tracks of albums, have a very different tone and feel to the main episodes. It's nice to cut loose on those as a way of saying thanks for your support. And to be frank, without that support, there would not be a podcast. For our 50th bonus episode, Matt and I are going to interview each other about our experience doing the podcast so far. I have no idea what Matt is going to ask me, and vice versa, so who knows what could come out of it. We may not be speaking by the end of it. I do expect it will be fun.
I'll tell you this much, Gavin. I'm going to ambush you. It'll be great. Listeners, if you'd like to speak to us on social media, search for Chartbeats on Facebook, Chartbeats AU on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find me on Twitter at Mr. Matt Denby.
And we'll see you in a couple of weeks for episode 51. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for lunch, Milo.